Well, as an organic farmer, I'm well versed in the detrimental effects of intensive agriculture on the land and the soil and the sad impacts on rural communities. But it's also something more and more of you are taking an interest in, especially from the perspective of improving health. Large-scale intensive farming practices, the use and abuse of fertilisers and other forms of intervention has not only left us disengaged from our food sources, it's robbed our food system of the diversity it needs to maintain vitality in the chain of production from soil to the table. Now, after 14 years running Feather and Bone, a butchery of ethically sourced meats in Sydney, proprietors Laura Dalrymple and Grant Hilliard have authored a book to illustrate the importance of taking a life, the life of an animal, into consideration. Yes, it's the ethical omnivore. And Laura and Grant, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Laura, you've noticed a lot of people coming to your butchery to source clean food, in effect as medicine.
Absolutely. It's really interesting, actually. We're not the first people to point out that there's an absolute epidemic of nutrition-related illnesses, from diabetes and autoimmune diseases through to all sorts of emotional and spiritual, almost spiritual issues that people have in relation to food. And
We don't have to be shy of using these religious terms at all, really.
Well, we don't think so, but it's interesting. People tend to dismiss you as sort of kumbaya, claptrap peddlers if you're not careful, you know. But it's very interesting. There is increasing evidence of the relationship between nutritionally compromised food and these health issues, which are escalating at an alarming rate. And so people are looking around for options, and one of those options is the search for food that feels as uncompromised as possible and is as clean and comes out of as clean a system as possible. And that's really what our business is dedicated to providing.
Grant, when you started up the butchery, you decided to look for diverse breeds of animals grown on farms that were managed as sustainably as possible. Was it difficult to find such farms?
Yes, it probably was at first, because there was no real sort of impetus for that within the meat world. There was a clear model of it with wine, where things were differentiated by variety and where they were grown, sort of, and had been for many hundreds of years. But for meat, it was essentially a generic commodity, and so trying to distinguish that initially was quite difficult. It took, you know, I was looking for one particular breed of lamb, and it took 6 months really to sort of nail that.
I've got to ask you what that breed was. We've had to destock because of the drought, but we've got a rare breed running around the place. Not many, but some. What rare breed were you looking for?
It was a Southdown lamb, and interestingly, I heard a piece on Radio National and plugged for the station, and it was about this woman saying that she had, if you hadn't eaten Southdown lamb, you'd never lived, and that seemed like a challenge of sorts. And so I thought, well, that's really interesting. In the restaurant that I work, we get endless amounts of, obviously fish is differentiated by the type of fish and beef to some extent, but certainly lamb was never differentiated like that. So it was a curiosity as much as anything, but what was a curiosity then, had a positive response, and that led to pigs, and that led on to a much more diverse, menu of different animals that we would source and from different farmers. And, of course, these farmers know each other, so they sort of refer you on as well.
Now, Grant, it all begins with a respect for soil, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the point that we have arrived at, I think, after that period of time. I mean, we were certainly focused on rare breeds to begin with, but increasingly, I suppose, what we've come to realise is that is a small product of the farm, of the biomass that a farmer cares for. What they actually sell to us to sell to our customers is a relatively small part of the biomass that they're caring for. And so we now focus on farmers that focus on soil. And we find that if they've looked after those considerations and that they've got the genetics of the animals right and that they're managing them correctly, that the whole, all those characters and qualities are embedded in the meat that they will sell us.
So now, Laura, I understand that if a farm management results in an increase of average topsoil cover from, say, 20 centimetres to 30, then the farmer has effectively added the potential to increase productivity by a whopping 50%.
Yes, isn't it fascinating? You know, we have these sort of inbuilt ideas that scale is really what we should be pursuing. And so when people think about expansion, they think about physical expansion. I must have more land so I can produce and grow more of this thing. But in fact, you know, it's sort of counterintuitive, but it's very interesting because when farmers farm in this way, what they can do is they can produce greater productivity out of actually a smaller expanse of land. They can actually take sections of their farm out of production, and by doing so, they can produce greater activity in the soil because the soil is allowed to rest and regenerate. That produces greater activity and greater dynamic capability, and you build topsoil and you build capability. And it's a mystifying thing, but it's counterintuitive for most people.
I thought I'd read everything on the subject, and quite a few of the books have been written on the farm, but I hadn't heard the term spongy, which is how the Europeans...
Oh, it's marvellous. And isn't it so descriptive? Bruce Pascoe talks about it in his book Dark Emu in a really powerful way, but it's mentioned all the way through those early accounts of first white settlers describing their horses' fetlocks sinking into the spongy ground. And anybody who's travelled, particularly over the last 3 or 4 years, then certainly the eastern seaboard of Australia knows that the ground is very far from spongy, and we really have a job to do to try to, you know, regain back some of that spongy capacity and fertility.
Grant, the real problem in Australia is that people seem not to want to pay for good food, and the pressure is down, down, down all the time. Mm. How's your business faring these days in that sort of atmosphere?
Well, I think that, you know, it sort of relates back to what we were talking about before. I think there's a genuine desire to reconnect with the sources of food. And there's a recognition that constantly paying less is likely to lead to a reduced output, a reduced thing that you buy. I mean, you can't just sort of keep paying less and expect the farmer to do well and expect the animals under that farmer's care to sort of prosper from that. And of course, the environmental concerns that come into that. So people who we deal with have at least made a decision and have a curiosity around that and want to, you know, sort of commit to a certain, you know, want to buy what they think will align with the values that they sort of see around them. I think last year with the drought, after a culmination of 3 years of drought in the eastern seaboard, we really felt that, you know, we were looking at the sort of the end of a sort of a period which was bringing things to a crisis point. And I think the fires sort of over the summer exacerbated that, and then COVID, of course, on top of it. So I think we've reached a sort of point where people are saying, well, you know, if I don't invest in food, what am I going to invest in?
Now, Napoleon famously said that an army munches on its stomach, and everyone says you are what you eat. But you've got a chapter with an interesting variation in the heading, "We are what our food eats." Tell me what that's about, Laura.
Well, fundamentally, if you imagine, there's a lot of talk these days, very welcome and excellent talk around the importance of gut microbiome to one's overall health. And if you think about how we've started to understand how powerful and critical the gut and our gut health is in our overall health, and how it's almost equivalent to in terms of determining our health, our gut is as powerful in a way as our brain. Animals are no different.
I'm sorry, say that again. The gut is as powerful as the brain.
Well,
gosh, that's a hand grenade to toss into the debate.
a lot of people are starting to reach that conclusion that it's got the same capacity to influence our bodies independently as our brain influences us.
Does that mean I'm going to have the guests gut tested before I let them on the program? I'm sorry.
It'll be mandatory.
I'll shut up. You push on.
Well, animals are no different, of course, naturally. So if an animal has a healthy gut biome and we're absorbing the material qualities of that animal into our bodies, we are, by extension, absorbing, you know, and adding to our gut biome with that animal. So if So what's important is that animals are given a diet which allows them to effectively self-medicate. So you imagine you've got cattle on your farm and presumably you have pastures which are diverse and rich in a whole range of different kinds of species of plants.
Well, we have now. It's rained again, yeah.
Now it's rained again, that's right. And so your cattle on any given day at any given hour will be eating really particular things, which they're eating because their bodies, their instincts, their guts are saying, you need more, you know, iron today, you need more magnesium today, you need more protein today. And so animals self-medicate. And when you eat, when you consume an animal that's had the opportunity to self-medicate and been given the opportunity to feed on really good quality pasture, for argument's sake, then you are imbibing something which is rich and strong and healthy, and that helps you. It is, you know, a fairly logical and straightforward, it's an extension of something that's really quite straightforward. If you eat something that's compromised, you yourself will be compromised. And in addition, if you eat something that's nutritionally compromised, and there's a very excellent, there's a lot of very excellent research done by animal behaviourists on what it is that animals seek when they, in their daily intake of food, and there's a particular percentage of protein that all animals seek as their primary target when they're eating, and once they've got enough protein, then their other needs are attended to. But if you're eating nutritionally compromised food, often you have to eat much more of it for your body to get the required amount of protein or the other minerals that you need. And that's where some of these, you know, issues like obesity and so on come into play. So the quality of our food is hugely important, which comes straight back to that health question that you asked before.
I'm having a gutsy conversation with Laura Dalrymple and Grant Hilliard. Now, Grant, we tend to only eat the standard white broiler. Tell me about summerlad chickens.
Oh, well, summerlad chickens were a response to the sort of genetic cul-de-sac that white broilers represent. I mean, they're the highly specialised end of a chicken breeding system that started post-war and post-Second World War and culminated in a bird that can go from 1 gram or 2 grams at when it comes out of the egg to harvest weight in about 35 days. And that's an extraordinary sort of conversion rate, but it also represents an extraordinary sort of compromise in the bird health itself and also the way it's raised and what it eats. I mean, these are birds that are designed to grow in sheds. The summerlad is a response from Michael Summerlad, so named after him because he was a chicken nutritionist and he sort of felt that we needed a bird in Australia that could deal outdoors with Australian conditions from extreme heat to extreme cold. And they're now grown from the tropics, northern tropics, all the way down to very cold parts of Victoria, and they actually do cope with those conditions remarkably well. So,
and if we are what our food eats, the summerland chickens are fed with grains that hold greater nutritional value than the standard chicken diet of cracked or milled grain.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. He's insistent that the chicken needs to do the work of breaking up the whole grain, which is sort of obviously what they would do if they were collecting that in the field, and that the cracking of that whole grain in their crop gives them the health that they need. Because, you know, it's not dissimilar to, you know, ground pepper that you would grind at the table versus pepper that's already been ground. A lot of the nutrient and a lot of the volatile oils that are inside that grain will dissipate very quickly if it's ground before, you know, a long time before you get to eat it, which is the same with flour, I guess.
Grant, you argue that the butchering of whole animals is becoming a dying art.
Yes, terrible pun, but there you go.
I didn't even notice there was one. Heavens, I must change my diet.
Well, unfortunately, the commodity meat market means that most butchers now receive the majority of their meat in boxes that are already, the muscles have already been taken off the bone, sealed in plastic and put into a cardboard box. So for most butchers, they're doing not much more than just portion cutting and maybe adding some marinade or sauce to it or something like that. So to actually butcher from whole carcass, which is what we do because we're buying directly from the producers, and is hard to find butchers who are trained in that, because the conventionally now apprenticeships don't really include much whole animal butchery, because most butchers don't have to sort of deal with that in their professional life. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If it doesn't happen and you don't need to do it, then we won't train people to do it, and therefore it becomes harder and harder to get people who have those skills and also that appreciation as well.
Laura, I'd like you to give a plug to a farm called Extraordinary Pork.
With absolute pleasure. Extraordinary Pork is an extraordinary story. It's a wonderful story. We may be wrong on this, but I think it's probably the only very small pasture-based pig farm in Australia that has its own on-farm abattoir. It's a very small, modest operation, but it's a wonderful, wonderful example of a very clever pair of farmers who looked at what their land could yield and farm only according to the capacity of their land. So they have a small herd of heritage breed pigs that are entirely pasture-raised, and they looked at the management. They looked first at the physical structure of the farm, so they got an expert, regenerative agriculture expert called Darren Doherty in to help them organise and plan their farm in a really particular way, so they harvested as much water as possible off the land and were as careful and prudent with their management as possible. And then the sort of final piece in the chain for them was to take control over the entire process from birth to death by putting this on-farm abattoir onto the farm. It's just a small operation, and the farms, the pigs are led off the pasture directly into a holding pen and then to a race where they're stunned and slaughtered. And it's I've witnessed it, and it is an extraordinarily benign and peaceful exercise, if you can say such a thing about the death of an animal that we're killing for food. But really, it's a marvellous operation and a great example.
Greg, some of us have been looking at the possibility of mobile abattoirs that sort of go from farm to farm. Mm. Do you think they've got a future?
Well, I think that increasingly farmers are frustrated by the process of having to send their animals often very long distances to abattoirs, where it's out of sight, out of mind a lot of the time for those producers. It's the one time that it's not in their care, and it won't be in our case, it won't be either in the farmer's care or in our care. And more things go wrong in that sort of journey to the abattoir and then to us than go wrong in maybe a 3 or 4 year life of a steer. It's the demand for ways to kill animals that minimise stress, improve meat quality, which is obviously a huge bonus from that process, and respect the animal. I mean, yeah. In the end, you have to confront this. You are killing an animal to eat. It is no small thing. And as soon as you think it is, that allows all sorts of horror. And we have to confront that as a society. We don't deal with death very well on any level, let alone the animals that we eat. We're very much sort of saying that it should be, you know, not so much foregrounded, but at least considered as part of the life cycle of this animal.
You've got a very good contribution or observation of the work of Temple Grandin, a professor of animal science, who sheds light on what not to do. Now, incidentally, I've got to point out that you note that one of the great inequities of the commodity meat market is that it only rewards weight, nothing else. not nutrient quality, not persistence of flavour.
Well, it's that's not just meat. I mean, that's the great lie of commodity markets generally, is that the only thing they reward is it's reduced to a single idea. And of course, we live in a much more complicated world than that, and we need metrics that are able to consider other ideas of value. So at heart, what we're trying to do is recalibrate value. What do you value this life at? What do you value the land that it's grown on and the consequences of raising that animal on that land? Are we prepared to reward farmers who are prepared to leave their land in better shape than they got it? Increase carbon levels, increase water storage. All of these things are crucial if we're going to have, you know, an Australia that we can live in and live in with some sort of equanimity. I mean, it's food is central to these discussions.
Look, I admire your passion and I admire also your writing skills. The book contains lots of great recipes as well. Good on you, Laura Dalrymple and Grant Hilliard. The book is called The Ethical Omnivore, and it's published now by Murdoch Books.